Nothing wrong with an Imperial Stout show.
No, it's always going to be a show that has its moments.
And on the bright side, guess what? I lose an hour of sleep tonight. My kids don't know that, right? So I get the same amount
That's
of sleep
right.
tonight.
That's right. Your kids are not aware of the way the clocks work. That's true. It's daylight savings time.
So someone listening is going to die from a heart attack tonight or tomorrow.
What?
Heart attacks go way up on the Switch nights.
Why?
The stress, the extra stress to the body of waking up early. Google it. Daylight savings, heart attack.
Okay, that sounds like more of a like an urban myth. That sounds like the kind of thing like, you know, oh, when the full moon's out,
okay, Google it. Right. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it is a urban myth, but I think there is real science saying that changing the clocks kills people. Nothing good? I guess I'm going to have to Google too.
There is a Science Daily article. Science Daily is something that is a source that I definitely trust. The source of the source is University of Alabama at Birmingham. The Monday and Tuesday after moving the clocks at 1 hour in March is associated with a 10% increase in the risk of having a heart attack.
There you go, man. Changing the clocks kills people.
That's I don't know if that's I mean, 10% is pretty statistically significant if that's true. And they say the opposite is true. When falling back in October, the risk decreases by about 10%.
You get more rest, right? I mean, that's the thing. People are already sleep deprived. You're taking an extra hour away. It depends on how much merit you put on sleep, right? How important is sleep, right?
Oh, it's such a web of things.
Well, right. Yeah. Okay, but sure, simplify it. Sleep's important, right?
Yeah. Yes.
And would you say that you are sleep deprived? Well, you're in a certain period in your life where you don't have many obligations, so maybe you're not.
No.
But when you do have those set obligations, would you consider yourself sleep deprived?
On the weekends, not so much.
Okay.
No.
You don't have kids.
Right.
I think most people, especially family people, you know, parents, mm-hmm. would consider themselves, especially when you read the guides of how much sleep is healthy, you know, and like useful, consider themselves sleep deprived. So you take a normal sleep deprived person and steal an extra hour away. See, take a normal sleep deprived American who is already unhealthy and has heart disease and steal an hour of sleep away from them.
Sure. There's a weird thing going on here because not only is daylight savings time a recent phenomenon, but the idea of accurate time is a relatively recent phenomenon. Mm-hmm. So that these things can have an effect on people, I guess, is not that strong. It's not that hard.
I don't know.
It's not that hard to believe because
starting a couple years ago, they made summertime daylight savings time from March to November.
Yeah,
it's almost the whole fucking year.
Yeah,
and I see the whole environmental energy consumption, you know, that's been debunked, right? You don't save energy by using daylight savings.
Right.
It's just people prefer
the
relative light dark schedule of daylight savings in the summer over standard time in the summer. They like having it light until bedtime. You know, it depends on what part of, you know, so we've talked about this before that where I was. When I went to New York City the week before Christmas, I was stunned how early it got dark, right? Mm-hmm. Because that's when I appreciated living in the eastern part of a time zone versus the western part of the time zone. Right, yeah. And we're not even in the western part of the time zone. We're not even two-thirds of the way over, practically.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the end of July, it's light till 9 o'clock here. You know, when you live in Indiana, it's light till like 9:45.
Right.
You know? And
it's funny being in Boston, you know, when the switch
in happens. Christmas. Yeah. Boston in Christmas, it's dark by like
5 o'clock.
It's dark by like
4:18.
It's like pitch black at 4:18. It's insane. Mm-hmm. And because when I was in New York, it was the same thing. And Boston's even further east, so it gets darker earlier. I was in New York the week before Christmas, and it was dark by like 4:30.
Mm-hmm.
It was insane. And
And we know there's things like seasonal affective disorder. We evolved to appreciate light. And we also evolve in most of human, from what we understand, from what we know, most of human evolution has been sort of around the equator, where
12-12.
It's pretty much 12-12 for the most, and we moved into these areas where really just recently on a reasonable, on any time scale that's not. And any time scale that's, you know, geologically, just within the last 1,000 years, which is nothing, we haven't fully adapted to it.
Right. So, I mean, people appreciate light more in the evening than they do in the morning, right?
Right.
So, I am all for making Eastern time GMT minus 4, you know, UTC minus 4. Not UTC minus 5. Because right now it's UTC minus 4 from March 9th to November 20th.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's UTC minus 5 from November 21st to March 8th. Why a standard time, a minority of the calendar? Shouldn't standard time be the majority of the calendar?
We're looking at this from an interesting perspective, though, because we're in cities, and there's wasn't the whole point of daylight savings time to, you know, wasn't there something about farms that it was?
So standard time is based on the sun being at 90 degrees at noon.
Okay.
Right?
Right.
So that's why there's standard time. Noon is when the sun's directly overhead. And then they, you know, figured out in the 30s, I think it was, that, you know, actually it was an environmental thing even then, right? Less energy is spent lighting houses by doing daylight savings time, shifting the time an hour so it's light an hour later. That's an hour less of the summertime that the lights are on.
I always thought that there was, and this could be apocryphal, I always thought it had something to do with the fact that there was a lot of rural kids that needed to work on the farms and things like that, and so they...
Well, no, they do the work in the morning, right? So it would make less sense. A lot of farm kids get up early, milk the cows before school. So it would make less sense to do daylight savings for farm kids.
Okay.
It was actually... I remember hearing that in the 30s, daylight savings was actually one of the first green movements where there was a proposition that... Because shifting the clock would cause it to be lighter later, you would need less electric light in the house before you go to bed.
I do know that. I know there's evidence.
Someone thought that, and that was a big part of the reason why they did.
Yeah. Well, there's been these things throughout modern history. Temperance movements and various environmental movements. There is evidence that being exposed to bluish light from electronic devices is bad for your sleep cycle. There is evidence that artificial light has really, you know, has really messed with our circadian rhythms.
Back to my part about how the average American is sleep deprived, or how you are sleep deprived. That's all that plays into that previous statement. But yeah, go ahead.
So, you know, there's what I'm surprised at is that there is actually, I mean, 10% is a pretty statistically significant number. I thought it would be like 2 or 3%, and then you could wave that off. But 10% for this heart attack change is really significant, I think. And you know, if that really does follow through in the statistics, and that's interesting. That really does.
The next question is, how many heart attacks are there in a week? What is the average heart attack rate for a week, right?
Oh, 5,480. I don't know.
Well, I'm just saying, what's 10% of that?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's so statistically significant and a number anyone cares about are two different things, right?
Yes.
So yes. How many people die in a week from a heart attack, and what is 10% more of that?
Here's a suggestion for how to avoid this, okay? The guy who is the person who does the study suggests wake up 30 minutes earlier on Saturday and Sunday than you need to in preparation for the early start on Monday.
Guess what? We're already missed out.
Yeah. Eat a decent-sized breakfast, go outside in the sunlight in the early morning, exercise in the mornings over the weekend, as long as you do not have pre-existing heart disease.
You know, the people that are dying aren't the ones that can consider exercising outside at 6 o'clock in the morning on Monday morning. Those aren't the people that are dying, the ones that can actually do that.
Well, I mean, this is not dying. It's heart attacks. It's not necessarily dying. I mean,
okay.
the science behind saving something with the heart attack has certainly improved over the years. I mean, it's not like it was when we were growing up, you know, in the 80s when heart attacks were really, really pretty much, you were almost gone at that point. It was lucky if you survived. And now it's like heart attacks are...
They ever tell you how my grandpa died?
No.
It's, so I was really pretty, I mean, out of all my grandparents, I was closest to my grandpa, my mom's side. They lived in Florida. They actually, I don't think you were ever at my parents' house in Franklin Park. No. He owned a store there, a little shop, little market at market superette on the corner. And parents got married. He owned a rental house next door. He gave that to them when they got married and whatnot. By the time I was born, he lived in Florida. My nanny and my papa would come up every summer and whatnot. And grandma died when I was probably fifth or sixth grade, whatnot. My grandpa lived for quite a while beyond that. And when I was a senior in high school, he came up. And he would always visit his friends up near Mercer or something like that. He was driving up there, had a flat tire on the way up. Got up, changed a tire. This whole change a tire thing aggravated a heart attack. So at night he woke up, wasn't feeling well, called the ambulance. By the time the ambulance got there, he was dead.
Wow.
Damn flat tire. Flat tire killed my grandpa. Who knows? You might have had a few years after that, right? Now, my grandpa, he lived a good life. Yeah. I never saw him drink anything other than coffee or beer.
Mm-hmm.
I never saw him drink. He would drink coffee until 3 o'clock. And at 3 o'clock, beer time.
Well, you know, there's so many factors in this. But, okay, as long as we're talking about death, I was hesitant to bring this up, but you brought it up. So I'm going to go into this because there have been two things that happened in this week that related to death and life. And I thought it would be interesting to discuss this. So the one thing is that my parents have had a brush with mortality because one of their, they're in their late 60s. One of their friends suddenly died. And they have a close-knit group of friends. And, you know, it's affected them. And I understand that because... It's similar to the way I reacted when one of my friends died in a car accident. It's not quite the same because that was a car accident versus this is something that is more likely to happen to them and this sort of thing. But they're confronted with their basically with their mortality, and it's a shock to the system. And in talking to my parents, you know, kind of came to the conclusion that we all, the ending of all of our lives is set in stone. You can't change
that. That it's going dead?
Yes. So, and what we do is we push that out of our minds. And the way I compared it to it is it's similar to if you're in a room, let's say, with a fluorescent light that's buzzing, after 20 minutes or so, you ignore that buzzing.
Right.
Your brain just tunes it out. And you just do what you do, and you know it's a constant thing that's on in there in the background, but your brain just pushes out of the way. And in a very similar way, your brain knows that there is an end, but it just pushes it out of the way of your thinking, and you're not confronted with it on a daily basis.
I mean, it's, you know, every teenager thinks they're immortal, right?
Yeah, but
and you don't lose that. I mean, there's sort of you yeah. hang on to part of that yeah. forever. You know, like right now, but I'm almost 40, you know, yeah. and I really don't expect to die before I'm 90, but I probably will.
But, you know, when someone close to you dies, it's like all of a sudden that buzzing gets really loud and it gets a whole bunch of blinking lights around it. And suddenly your attention is just drawn to that. And you have no choice but to concentrate on it. As much as you don't want to, you're concentrating on that, and that's it affects the way that you think for a whole bunch of time until your brain can finally adjust and get rid of that and go back to its normal operation of ignoring the basic idea that, hey, it's all going to end at some point. It's a weird, and you know, it's great that our brain does this for us, because if we were just constantly contemplating our own mortality, it doesn't seem like we'd be a very successful species. And yet,
well, I mean, there's a. When you said it's a successful species, it really pulled in what I was thinking. It was about the whole free will thing, right? Like, you know, the laws of the universe as we see them, you know, it's a bunch of random chance. Everything's predetermined, all that stuff, right? So you really don't have any free will, right? But you feel like you do. Like right now, I could feel like I could go upstairs and eat the rest of the birthday cake.
Yeah.
Or I could not. I could go, or I could go run 2 miles, you know, and I lean towards the thing like, you know, it's predetermined with, you know, some random chance, you know, thrown in, right? It's not like I can actually choose to live longer, you know, it's predetermined. But because you don't know that, you really don't. You still have to do the work, right?
Heisenberg destroys.
Even though you're not going to change the outcome, you still have to do the work to get to the outcome, right? And I have to decide whether I want to live healthier or not. Even though the answer is predetermined, I don't know that, and I still have to. It's been predetermined that I have to struggle over that. Well, it's been predetermined that I'm going to struggle over that fight.
That's not well. Yes, but no. Okay, so did I bring up Zeno in the last show?
Zeno? You mean Zenu?
No, Zeno's paradoxes.
Not Zenu's paradoxes?
No.
No volcanoes?
No.
Okay.
So most of our, you know, people will okay, most of our philosophy comes really from the ancient Greeks. Our basics of philosophy comes from the ancient Greeks. And there was there was a lot of thought and a lot of, you know, before people realized you could do empirical testing, there was just sort of a lot of thinking. And Zeno's paradoxes were this idea that infinity is something that can't be conquered, and so therefore, like, the example is Achilles versus the tortoise, right? The running. But essentially the idea is in order to go from point A to point B, you have to go halfway. In order to go that halfway, you have to go another halfway. In order to go that halfway, mm-hmm. you have to go another halfway. And so there's an infinite number of halfways, and how can you beat an infinity? And so that was a big problem for thousands of years. People didn't know how to approach that problem. And then, you know, Newton came around, and I should give credit to Leibniz too, but Newton gets a lot of credit because he did it almost on a dare. He did it almost just to spite the people he was such a genius. But anyway, Newton came along, turned Zeno's paradoxes into math, and basically destroyed them, basically just crushed them. And said, okay, these very ideas that you have just can be crushed with the right interpretation of the data. What we have is Newton still thought that there was this clockwork universe, but now we know through Heisenberg and other things that no, that's not the way things work. There is uncertainty in everything. Now, that's not to say that the uncertainty necessarily gives you free will, but it does mean that you cannot predict with clockwork precision how exactly something is going to turn out, because there is always uncertainty in the measurement.
Right. Uncertainty in the measurement. But, I mean, how would you characterize this statement, right? I'm going to fret over a decision.
Yes.
For a long time. But isn't the outcome more or less predetermined?
Well, it's based on your previous experiences, which are based on your environment, it's all coupled together, right? Right.
There's not that much
entanglement with everything else.
There's not that much randomness in there, right? I mean,
the whole point of Heisenberg is that
does will arise from the randomness?
No. No, will, as far as we know, doesn't arise from randomness, but randomness is included in everything. There's a fudge factor, and in fact, when you get down to it, things are spread out.
Okay, so but back to my earlier statement, is the fretting predetermined? Right? It's not like you can just say, fuck it.
Well, it's not like quantum indeterminacy means that you have free will in the libertarian free will sense, in the sense that you actually have control over your decisions as a sort of ghost in the machine, as a sort of, you know, you can override your programming because you have some sort of maximal power over your thing. That's not what quantum indeterminacy says. Some people interpret it that way, but that's not the way it works. It just means that you can't take a starting condition and predict the end after an arbitrary period of time when you consider everything together, because you have indeterminacy in your values, and it could go in ridiculous in off ways. That doesn't mean that it certainly seems to be true that your decisions are based almost entirely on your past experiences and the way that you have built up a heuristic of the world that your brain interprets and uses to decide things. So quantum indeterminacy doesn't give you free will because the universe is not a clockwork universe. But it does say that you cannot just go back in time, run the universe again, and everything will turn out the same. In fact, it says that if you were to run the clock back somehow and run it again, right. It would...
I know, I hear
there's,
that.
There's no...
I want to focus on the fretting about a decision.
Okay.
Right? So, again, talk about the, you know, longevity thing, right? I have a couple decisions once we finish the show, right? I go eat the rest of the birthday cake that's upstairs.
Mm-hmm. I may have a piece of that birthday cake.
You may.
Because I don't necessarily get a lot of cake.
Right. So that's one choice.
Yes.
Another choice is to do the opposite. To go burn 2,000 calories before I go to sleep.
Burn 2,000 calories?
That's a lot of running. But, you know, somewhere up to there, right?
Are you going to go swimming for 6 hours?
You know. Whatever. There's the by default, right? So I could just stay awake for 6 days and burn 2,000 calories as well.
Yeah. Sure.
But, you know, you feel have these choices, right? Like, for health reasons, right? Like, longevity reasons, right? Like, because that's where this started, right? We were talking about your parents and whatnot. Yeah. And really, you fret about... Should I make these choices or not? Should I have the cake or not? And how much of that is predetermined and is almost...
How much of that is meaningful is the real question. How much... Okay.
I mean, I would like to think that you could be a better person by choosing to be a better person, but then there's the whole, hey, you know, it's just interactions of particles and... There's a pen behind your screen there. It's just interaction of particles, and more or less it's going to happen. What's going to happen, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And this is the other point I wanted to get to.
But part of the what's going to happen is you fretting about the decision, right? You can't bypass that fretting.
It's part of your programming. It's part of the stuff that we developed on top of the stuff that was developed before us.
It's like you just can't say fuck it because, I mean, some people can.
Some people can, sure.
But most people aren't going to fuck it because they cannot let go of the illusion of free will. And if they decide to let go of the illusion of free will,
And they can't let go of the illusion of self. And that's the big...
Well, thing. That's... But if they... Even if they do, they have to come to the exception of... Well, that's the decision that's going to be made anyway, right? Like, I'm just going to be this lazy-ass bum forever. You know, it's
well,
like...
I really,
but that was predetermined,
I really do believe that the self is an illusion. That we have this illusion of consciousness, which doesn't jive with what we know about reality. That we feel like we're sort of in control, and we can separate ourselves out from the world, but it's very much a product of a bunch of processes running in our brain. I mean, the analogy I always use is that, so I have a computer running right beside me that's just essentially, it's got a couple processors running in sync that are doing basically simple arithmetic. For the most part. And yet...
Why don't you pull up Amazon while you're talking and we can get there.
Okay, but yet I look at this and there's a desktop and there's a couple different programs that are running. But the processor isn't actually doing...
Process back.
Whatever. Right about there. Whatever. The processor isn't actually doing this. This is an emergent property of all the stuff that's going on inside it. This is an illusion that the computer is presenting. The self is an illusion that your brain is presenting to you. And you accept it because A, we evolved to accept it, and B, it's nicer to think about that than to think about the idea that we're a processor running a couple programs because that's how we evolved. It doesn't feel as... It feels almost jaded to think of itself as not.
It actually comes... Maybe it can be distilled down to almost a religious thing, right? I mean, like... think of a religious person wanting to know all, you know, all of knowledge that they get at heaven. Right. Wouldn't it be nice to know that, you know, you don't have to try hard to do shit because it's just going to happen? You know? I mean, that's almost like a, that's almost like getting that realization, you know, in heaven, right? That, you know, like, you know.
But you don't have to try hard. That's the whole point.
But what if you have self-control? What if you have free will? And by working hard, you can succeed versus predeterminism. Right? Like, do I go to work tomorrow or not? Or call off sick, you know? That kind of thing.
Well, I don't understand what your point is.
If everything is predetermined, then why try?
Well, everything's not predetermined, but yet, why try is a good question.
Why try is because you think that you have the free will to change your outcome and make a better experience for yourself.
To what end? To what end?
To make it a better and more successful experience for yourself.
The other thing that I wanted to bring up, and this relates to us, that's why this is not a... I'm not trying to change a subject here.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I talked about last week how I did, you know, I've been chatting on philosophy chat rooms and whatever. There was a guy who came onto the chat room who was seemingly in a very depressed state and was really, I wouldn't say he was suicidal, but he was definitely, he didn't like where he was. He didn't like contemplating death. And, you know, I talked to him and I felt good because I think I talked him down from a ledge by giving him my interpretation of life and what's going on. And really, and I just want to sort of elucidate this if I could. Sure.
Yeah, sounds interesting. Go for it.
So,
pull up Amazon Anonymous while you're
talking. I have it.
Okay.
So there is... The way that you and everything else in the universe are a collection of waves. That seems to be the way things work. Everything is a collection of things that we can describe as waves, collected and collated. When you die, those waves decohere from each other, but they don't stop existing. They just go on to exist in other ways. They become parts of other things. So what was you isn't really lost. Your information is
dirt and memory, right?
It still affects the world. And so you're never really lost. In the same way that you never really existed like you thought you did. You were just a different combination, and you will turn into a different combination at another point. And, you know, we don't know if there's an end or not. We don't know if there's an infinity or not. But if there is an infinity, then all the odds point to the almost certainty that you're going to repeat again.
Really? I thought that as energy is lost, information is lost, and you're just going to fizzle out.
Well, I mean, that's the current cosmological models seem to suggest a heat death. But in an infinite universe, that doesn't necessarily matter. If infinity goes, if things go on...
People really don't want to live... Or have their waves or information live for infinity, right? They just want a couple thousand years is plenty, right?
Well, I'm not going to get into that because that's a little bit. But the point is that over an infinite period of time, you will infinitely repeat your life. There's really essentially no way around that because.
Because infinity is a funny number.
Yeah, and everything happens. It's not a number.
Everything happens in infinity.
Yeah. So, and we can't get away from the idea that the infinity system. I mean, we can mathematically deal with it, like Newton dealing with Zeno's paradoxes and dealing with infinity, but he seemed, the person I talked to seemed to be very comforted by the idea that he was going to repeat again and again and again and again. Now, he wouldn't necessarily realize it, mm-hmm. but in an infinite universe, you repeat an infinite amount of times. There's... Okay, it's not necessarily true. It's what we would mathematically say almost certainly, which means it's 100% chance it happens, but that doesn't mean it happens. I've explained this before. If you were to flip a coin, right, an infinite amount of times, then there's 100% chance that it will at one point turn up tails during that infinite series. 100% chance, but mathematically that's considered almost certainly, because it is in essence possible for you to constantly flip heads, mm-hmm. heads, but there's 100% chance that over infinity you're going to flip a tails at some point, but it doesn't necessarily have to happen. It's the weird thing about the maths.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the world as, the best way we understand it, as just a collection of waves and stuff like that, then you're a transitional period between other things, and yourself, like we said, is sort of an illusion, and it's not going to be bad. It's just going to be different.
Right. Sounds good.
All right. On to our Amazon Anonymous.
Okay, so my item. However, someone bought some new RAM and an SSD for their laptop. I like that. Nice, fast laptop now. I'm going to go with the... Where'd it go? I lost it. Someone bought shit. No, not shit. Just shit. Maybe it wasn't earnings. Maybe it was just an order. Let me find it again. Even if I didn't make any money on this thing, I still liked it a lot. And it is the... Where'd it go?
I'll bring up mine while you're trying to search.
Okay, I just found it.
Something about a really cool watch. Okay. Cool looking watch. Kenneth Cole, New York Men's, KC9109. Pretty cool. That's a cool looking watch.
Yeah, I saw it. Yeah. Nice watch, yeah.
Yeah. I will admit this, even though it's not very flattering. It takes me time to interpret a clock. It still does. I mean, it doesn't take me much time.
Uh-huh.
But I like digital over just plain old...
See, there's a thing about analog clocks, right? And analog speedometers. Have you ever had a car with a digital speedometer?
No.
So the thing you don't get with digital that you get with analog, with a clock, it's a little bit different than a speedometer, but it's the same kind of thing. With a clock, you can better judge the time from or the time to, right? That's why when you have face clocks, analog clocks, you can say it's 9:45. Right? Because you have a 360-degree circle. You have 9:45. It gives you a relative measurement. With a digital clock, 9:45 would never have become common parlance.
Right. You say 9:45.
Right. It would have never come common parlance. Yeah. Now, with a digital speedometer, I have a 2006 Honda Civic, I think. I think it's 2006. I know it's a Civic. That's the part I know. Year I don't. I think it's six. Digital speedometer. It took a long, long time Because with the analog speedometer, you can judge rate of change, the delta. Like, okay. Like how, how quick, how quickly you're getting to 60 miles an hour. You can judge by the, how fast the needle's moving across the circle. With a digital speedometer, you can't as easily judge rate of change. And it took a lot of conditioning.
Yeah.
On in my car to because when I first got my car, you would say the speed limit was 65. You would be at 60, you would get to 68, you'd slow down to 62, you'd get up to 69. It was really hard to keep it at 65 because you couldn't judge the rate of change as well.
I think that's just in the way you interpret the data. You interpret the inputs.
With a needle on an analog speedometer, you see it coming up to your desired speed, well, and you can
do.
Back off.
You do, but I'm more in tune with the digital. I think I would be fine with the digital because I feel like for me, the digital works better. The clock, the precise timing of the clock, actually is more. I don't think in this analog way. I think digitally.
Clock, sure. Speedometer, I beg you to listen.
No, speedometer, I think I
you
would...
You don't accelerate at a constant speed.
No.
And that's where the problem is. A clock ticks at a constant speed.
Yes.
A speedometer is variable.
Well, yes, for the most part.
In your experience, yes. A clock ticks at a constant speed. Mr. Oh, I could travel with the speed of light. Fuck you.
No, well, to you, the clock ticks at night.
To you.
In your frame of reference, the clock always ticks at a constant.
To you, yes. The clock's... The speedometer is variable speed. And that... Now, I've had the car for a long time now, and it's natural to me. But it took a good many months... dare I say 8 months to get the hang of a digital speedometer.
There are other things though that there are other. I mean, like thermometers. I prefer digital thermometers to regular thermometers, and that's another gradient that
it does vary. Now think of the times you're using it. Right, if you're using it for the weather, the rate of change is not that drastic. If you're using it for,
it can be.
Not that it matters.
Okay.
You're not going to catch fire because the thermometer is raising too quickly and you can't adjust fast enough. Now, cooking...
But you can see that in a digital thermometer, too. You just have to adjust the way you interpret the data and see the numbers going...
It's harder to parse...
For you. It's harder for you to parse the digital, but right. Not for me. For me, I think
you're it's saying, easier for me. You're saying it's easier for you to see three updates of a digital thermometer that's jumping by 6 degrees versus the sweep of an arm.
Yes, it is for me.
You have to do the math to figure out what it's changing by, and then see what each update changes by versus the relative sweep of an arm.
It's not doing math. It's just I get a feel for the digital very quickly, and I have to spend time interpreting a non-digital that I would not spend otherwise. I have to spend actual brain power doing that, and it's because I, for whatever reason, I don't have just a natural affinity to understand.
There's not very many cases that judging several degrees in several seconds is important, right? Even cooking, when you're roasting something, roasting something in the oven, yes, candy cooking, yes. How often do you do hardball? Okay, exactly. So when you're roasting something in the oven, it's still very slow, right? You set the alarm. When you get to 145, yes, whatever, yes. You take it out, whatever. When you're heating a pan for eggs, that's probably the most, other than candy cooking, that's the most exact thing I can think of. Mm-hmm. And even then, I am fine with my digital infrared thermometer. I don't need an analog sweeping of arm. Mm-hmm. It's not... precise enough to be important. When you're driving a car with a speedometer, I think that's a whole different level of precision. And I would like you to drive my car sometime.
I've driven like rental cars with speedometers, okay, and I haven't had that problem.
Only a number, yeah, and no gauge.
Yeah, and I haven't had that problem. I just think it's a way that you and I are different. To me,
so when you took that rental car, you could go to 65 degrees and stop at 65 degrees and stay exactly there, not float above and below without much practice.
Well, I don't think
I said degrees. I meant miles per hour, but
I don't think you do that in a regular analog speedometer either. It's just that you hit a point and you fluctuate around that point and you don't have an exact number, so it seems like you're at that rough point.
Okay. So, but in my experience, you're accelerating. You're coming up to 65 with a analog speedometer. You can gauge that you have this much to go, and you ease off the gas, and you watch your needle ease into your target thing, right?
But why can't you do that digitally?
To me, it wasn't as easy. To me, it took a lot.
To you, it isn't as easy. To me, it's easier.
But you have to do math. You want to go to?
No, I
you do have
math.
To do. Shut up! You do have to do math. You're going to 65 degrees. You're at 65 miles per hour. You're at 48 miles per hour. You have to figure out how many miles per hour different there is. You have to divide that by the amount of time you want to get there. And you're doing math. With an analog thermometer, you're slowing the needle down to get to your destination. There's no math involved. Other than like just visualizing like half.
Of course there's, if you're saying.
You're not doing numerical math. You're doing halves.
Then there's math involved in doing it. You know, in doing the calculus and figuring out how the rate of change goes. It's math either way, but you just have a natural sense of it. And for me, the natural sense comes better to me in the digital than does it in the analog.
I'm not disagreeing with you completely. I understand clocks. But things with constant rates of change, I don't have an argument with you. I just don't think you've driven a car with only a digital speedometer and have seen how hard it is to dial in you're nailing the rate of change and getting into right where you want to go. Maybe I'm an idiot. Maybe you are programmed for base 10 numbers and dividing them really quickly. I'm not. I guess. Maybe that's what it comes down to. But I am skeptical.
We're all different. It's just,
I'm
just
skeptical of your argument. I'm skeptical of your argument, and you just haven't experienced a car with a digital speedometer.
I'm not really arguing. It's just I'm pointing out to you the way
okay,
that
I'm arguing your statement. Okay. All right. I'm skeptical of your statement then.
Okay. I mean, you're allowed to be skeptical. In my experience, it's been the case that digital works for me in a much more intuitive manner than analog. I can't explain why. I can't explain why. It's just that's what works for me. We've discussed this in the past. My brain is messed up. My brain is considerably different than most other brains that I know of. I have a really weird, fucked up brain. For whatever reason, digital works for me. Digital, I interpret really easily. And analog, I don't.
So, I don't argue that anymore. A little more insight on my digital speedometer Honda Civic experience. In the old car, when I'm going, let's say 58, and I want to get to 65, and I feel the G-forces on my body of the acceleration, mm-hmm, and I correlate that with a needle, I was able to ease off the gas as I'm getting there, mm-hmm, to nail the final speed. I keep messing up terms. I'm talking about speed even though I keep saying temperature. When I got the new car, it's 58, I want to get to 65, and the numbers are changing, and the update isn't 60 hertz, right? It's not bop, 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 bop. I don't know how fast my car updates the speedometer, but it's maybe 5 times a second, something like that. You know, it's not a lot, right? So you see update, 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 update. And you're going from 55, 57, 59, 65. And you go over. You go 66, 69. You ease off. 65, 64. 60, you put more gas in. And because you couldn't, you didn't have as much resolution as you do with the needle. Because the update, okay, maybe it's not math. Maybe it's the refresh rate of the speedometer that's the problem.
No, I accept that that's the way that you interpret what's going on.
Because with a needle, you have as much resolution in change as your eyes can perceive, which is hundreds of cycles a second. You know, it's blah, 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 blah. And with the digital speedometer, it's bup, 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 bup. And for me, it wasn't enough information. Maybe that was it. Maybe it is, I'm giving you some wind here, right? It's not a merit of, it's all about what you've learned, what you're used to, what you have been accustomed to, right?
It's all about what you're comfortable with.
But with the sweeping analog speedometer, you have a ridiculous amount of resolution.
Well,
you can see that thing moves a hundredth of an inch. No? And with the digital speedometer, it only updates several times a second, if that. Next time I drive my car, I'm going to have to look and see how frequently the speedometer updates. But if it only updates 4 or 5 times a second, that's significantly less information you're getting.
Think about...
If it updates, like, say it updates... Okay. Say you could update your digital speedometer 100 times a second, right? The number would be flickering so much you couldn't read it at that point, so they slow it down. But say you could get that much information. Maybe you could intuit the rate of change better. But because it's such a limited cycles per second of update, you can't intuit the rate of change on a digital speedometer as much as you can on an analog. Do you hear what I'm saying?
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. What I'm thinking is that you're making an assumption that I don't feel is correct about analog speedometers, which is that you are constantly being updated, like you say, hundreds of times per second about the rate of change. That's not actually the case.
It's as fast as you can see where the needle is.
Your eyes don't work that way. Your eyes have
30 times a second. Whatever.
Your eyes have a frame rate that's roughly 10 or 12 times a second, and your brain interpolates the difference between one and the other.
Okay. All right. Okay. Okay. So 12, 24, 30 frames per second, somewhere in there, right?
Right.
My digital speedometer does not update 24 frames a second.
No.
So you're getting less information.
You're getting less information in terms of, you know, updating in per second. This is true. But for me...
I'm talking about rate of change. Greg, I'm not talking about reading a digital clock. I'm talking about rate of change of a digital speedometer.
Sure, sure. I agree.
My Honda Civic does not update its digital speedometer fast enough to be intuitive of rate of change.
For whatever reason, now I haven't driven your car, so I don't know how your speedometer works, but for whatever reason, the speedometers that I've driven, which includes rental cars and my parents have some cars that have digital speedometers, have been very easy for me to interpolate that data and not have a problem with it. Whereas, now, I'm not saying the speedometers, that analog speedometers are hard for me to interpret. They're really just as easy. But I don't have a problem with that. Whereas, when it comes to clocks, for whatever reason, I have to expend brain power to interpret the time. Not much, but certainly more than digital. I have to think about the interpretation of the clock in analog, and I don't have to think about it in digital.
Okay.
And
I hear you. And for me, for the speedometer, to stay on 65 miles an hour and not go to 64 or 66 miles an hour, it takes more cycles of computation than it does with an analog thermometer or analog speedometer. Because I would love if my speedometer had tenths of a mile per hour. So when I was having, I don't know if you've ever come across this. When I was in school, middle school, I think, and I was taking a technical drawing class, the teacher taught me one of the best things that a teacher has ever taught me. When you're measuring something, you know, it has marks on it, right? So you have a ruler that goes down to 30 seconds of an inch, right?
Mm-hmm.
You go one level deeper, right? Because there's a space between the last markings that are on the ruler, right? So maybe 30 seconds. Don't think of 30 seconds. Think of 16ths of an inch, right? Or no, let's use millimeters, even better.
Okay.
Because we're not doing crazy base 2 math. You have a metric ruler with millimeters on it, and you measure something, and you look at this where it actually ends, and you look at the space between the gradients on the ruler, and you estimate the next decimal point, right? So you can say that is 12.5 millimeters, or 12.7 millimeters, or 12.9 millimeters. You estimate that last one. Have you ever come across that?
I've never heard it elucidated in that manner.
So in a technical drawing class, I was told this, right? And it really is an important thing that stuck with me forever, is you find where this falls between the last thing that's listed on the scale, and then estimate the next decimal point down, right? So if it's a millimeter ruler, you shouldn't say it's 12 millimeters. You should look at it more closely and say, that's about 12.2, 12.4, 12.9. You know, wherever it falls in between that space between the 2 millimeters, you kind of break that up visually, mentally, and put tenths of a millimeter in there.
So the lesson I learned is kind of similar, but kind of completely different, which is that measurements are meaningless without error bars. If you don't have an idea of what your possible error is, then your measurement is absolutely meaningless.
Right. Okay, so back to the millimeter thing. With a millimeter ruler, you could say this is 12.4 millimeters within 3/10 of a millimeter?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
That's a reasonable accuracy statement.
Yeah.
So, yeah, my teacher never really put the error bar in, right? It's kind of relative what you figure there. But when you're looking at tenths of a millimeter,
it's kind of the same thing, but it's just taken from different angles.
Well, yeah. I mean, you could have two different people with two different error bars, right? You could read Jeff says this is 12.3 millimeters. And you could say, well, I figure Jeff can be accurate within 6/10 of a millimeter.
Right.
Where I think I'm accurate within 3/10 of a millimeter. So, yeah, I mean, I guess that's where the error bars come in. Teacher never went that deep. But we're talking to 7th graders at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know if you ever heard about error bars in 7th grade or not.
I don't remember when it was that I learned this, but it was definitely, you know, it was striking to me and important to me to learn that bit. Just as
I use that even today, though. You know, when I'm estimating something, right? I'll take the measurement, and then I will look at the space between the measurements and guess or intuit how far that is between the measurements, down to the next, you know, decimal point. You know, is it 1/10, 2/10, 3/10, 4/10, 5/10, you know, up to 9/10, right? And figure out where that fits. Because actually, if you do this kind of thing, I mean, you can kind of split up a space between two markings in half and then in half again.
I think this naturally shows where our difference is, because you are looking at an analog thing and then you're estimating.
This is very analog.
It's very analog. Where I'm looking at it and saying, okay, there's a number what's my possible error on that? It's this much or this much. So I'm within this area of this particular number. So I'm still thinking digitally and you're thinking analog because you're thinking about...
All right. Hold on. I want to pause real quick. Okay. Be right back. All right. We're back. I grabbed a steel ruler here with metric markings on it and this card. And I would like you to measure that card for me. And I want you to give me your best measurement on that card in metric.
So this starts at it doesn't start at the beginning, it starts here, right? So hate analog. Roughly 8.8 millimeters.
You mean 88 millimeters?
Yeah.
Dude, you don't know how to measure at all. This card is... .2 millimeters. And see, this is where I do the .2 because it's slightly beyond the 89 millimeter mark, but not halfway, so it's not 89.5.
Now remember what I said. What did I say?
What did you say? You said like 85 or something like that.
No, I said roughly 88 millimeters.
Well, you said 8.8 millimeters.
8.8, but
that's less than a centimeter.
Yeah, roughly, but what I meant, you know, I wasn't, right. This just goes right. From 1 to 9, so I was thinking on that level.
But again, you only went down to the millimeter where I went. Yeah. I went.
But I said roughly. I said roughly. So I was saying,
thought you were being all digital and shit.
Well, no, the very point I was making was about that there is error bars.
Well, right.
So,
but your roughly is within like 7 millimeters, and my error bar is within, you know, 4/10 of a millimeter.
Wait, I said 88, and you said 89.something. That's
89.2. But you said roughly 88. You didn't even give it a tenth of a millimeter, so your error bar is inherently big.
My error bar is inherently several millimeters. Is larger than yours, yes. I'm willing to give it more, because I don't think it was that important a measurement.
All measurements are important.
Roughly 88 is about right.
No, I was just talking about trying to be exact about tenths of a millimeter.
Well, see, that's where you and I differ. That's where you and I interpret the data in a completely different way. To me, roughly 88 is pretty much nailing it. I mean, yeah, I mean, it could be 1 or 2 millimeters.
Actually, you
either
know,
way.
Now measuring 88.9. So my error bar, I guess, is between 88.9 and 89.2, 3/10 of a millimeter off.
So, I mean, you know, I'm within 1 or so millimeters of you.
You
and
just
that's,
won't let me win any argument, will you?
You're the one who got angry about it. I wasn't really interested in argument. But I'm just explaining to you. I'm not saying that your method is wrong. I'm just saying that my method works for me. And I'm also saying that I'm crazy and messed up and my brain is ridiculous. So I'm not saying that my method is better. What I'm saying is that for me, my method is better. But if I were to ask, if someone were to ask me who's better at measuring something to the finest degree, I would say Jeff, not me. I would absolutely say Jeff wins in this regard because Jeff will be more Jeff intuits these things better than I do. I don't intuit these things to the same level Jeff does. It's just the way I work. I intuit other things to a level that Jeff doesn't. But Jeff, in terms of measurement, that Jeff has me beat easily.
All right, so let's finish the Amazon Anonymous, okay, if you will. Right. My item, and this has to do with measurement as well, ironically, someone bought a military prismatic sighting compass with pouch for $9.49, shipped by Amazon Prime. And this is one of those compasses where the little sight thing where you're out in the field and you're looking at things through the compass. These aren't good compasses.
Really?
No, they're not. Why not? They're not what you want. I'm a Boy Scout. I'm an orienteerer. Mm-hmm. I have done...
Again, measurement. Jeff knows this.
One
stuff.
Of my... So
if you're asking somebody to, you know, if you're asking somebody to do cartology or that kind of thing...
Cartography?
Cartography.
Cartology is kind of like, oh, I feel these mountains. They have such good aura.
Okay. if you're asking somebody to know that kind of thing, then Jeff is
even what the
too.
Word is.
Yeah. Okay. No, yeah, no. Look, you're way better than me at this stuff. Don't interpret that wrong. You have a knack for this stuff, and I don't.
So in Scouts, my favorite part of Scouting was what they call Scout Craft, and that was things like map and compass, orienteering, lashing, you know, tying sticks together with ropes and building towers and stuff like that. That was my favorite stuff.
I could never even understand the basic knots. I have trouble
with...
We'll
teach you some knots sometime. I know my knots. I'm a knot bitch.
I'm sure you do.
But, so with orienteering, the compass I prefer is a, I guess what they would probably call a map compass. It's... typically clear plastic, is flat, it doesn't have to flip up piece with the sight thing, and it's plenty accurate enough when you're trying to do sighting in the field as well, and it's much better on a map than this thing. This thing is the same kind of thing you see all the time with sighting compasses. It has a non-translucent body, so you can't put it on a topographic map. It has this little flip-up thing with this little eyepiece, the little sight piece, like a scope, like a gun scope, right? And you really don't need that kind of accuracy when you're sighting orienteering. It does have a bubble level, which is kind of nice. If you're building a deck, I'm not sure where you would need that when you're doing compass work. So my, you know, preferred compass is a... Let's see if I can... I just searched Google for compass. I found some old bronze thing that's a piece of crap. Some Bear Gillis thing that's another piece of crap. More Bear Gillis crap. Crap, 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 crap. Where's the good comp? Where'd all good compasses go?
You know, we've actually talked about this before, or this subject before, in different contexts with these telescopes, right? I mean... You loved learning how to work the equatorial
map. So search for a map compass, and you'll see a bunch of compasses with clear bottoms.
Like, I remember those from Boy Scouts, sure.
This is the good compass right here. Yeah. This one here, the SE compass map with ruler, it's $3.44. So as long as the magnet checks out, actually this thing only gets one star, but the physical makeup of this compass is good shit. You can use this in the field just like you can on a map. It has 360-degree rotating barrel. It has a ruler on the side. It has a sight line thing. It's all translucent. You put it on a topographic map. It's perfect. This is, as long as the actual magnetic needle points north, you are good to go with this compass. And this is the one I would recommend 10 times out of 10 over... some goofy sighting compass or Bear Grylls emergency bullshit compass.
That should be the name of something. I don't know if I'd buy it, but I'd endorse it.
What, Bear Grylls emergency bullshit compass?
Yes.
I did buy this Gerber Bear Grylls fire starter.
Yeah, I actually have one of those too because I just think they're cool.
I don't even know
where it is now, but
mine's
cool.
Mine's right over there in that blue box, probably. Yeah, I bought this.
When I was on an Amazon spree like 2 years ago, I was like, yeah, a fire starter. That's a pretty cool idea. Yeah, I know.
You're like, you're ever going to build a fire.
Yeah. It's ridiculous. Stupid.
But it's a whistle, too. The little toggle thing here is a whistle. So, I mean, they Bear Grylls, like you know, Bear Grylls stuff doesn't all suck, right? Like, he has the whole fancy bracelet that turns into rope type stuff. You know, like, oh, it's a little braided bracelet. I'm so cool. I can wear this
parachute cord, yeah.
Yeah, parachute cord. And, yeah, it's nice to have 12 feet of rope when you're fucked. You know, you can do a lot of shit with 12 feet of rope. So, you know, I'm not going to, you know, really knock that so much. But any of these Bear Grylls compasses or like that, what the fuck is that good for? Nothing. The sun will tell you better accuracy than that. Anyway.
But we've talked about this analog versus digital thing before in relation to telescopes, right? I mean, you love...
That's not analog versus digital. That is...
Kind of is.
No,
it's kind of this.
No, it's not. It is. It's mechanized versus manual. Is that's not analog versus digital?
Well, I mean, you loved figuring out how the equatorial mount worked. To me, that was just like I didn't want to be bothered with that.
Right, but that's not. But that to me, that has nothing to do with analog versus digital. Other than the computer doesn't use analog. That's manual versus autonomous. That's all that is. That has very little to do with analog versus digital.
I think it's related. I feel it's related, but you might be right.
No, because for me, it's not like... I like doing the manual telescope because of the skill required.
Yeah, right, yeah.
I don't like... analog speedometers because of the skill required. I prefer analog speedometers because of the it's more
accuracy,
intuitive. I don't want to overload terms, but for me personally, less skill is required. It's more intuitive. Where with the digital speedometer, I had to learn a new skill.
Okay. I totally understand that. I'm just saying that for me, the digital
when I'm telescoping, it's like when I'm orienteering. I like a compass instead of a GPS. Mm-hmm. I like using the skill. Okay? So those are similar, right? When I'm orienteering and when I'm astronomying, telescoping, I like proving my worth. I like proving the skill. When I'm driving a car, I want it to be intuitive and easy.
Well, there were two reasons. Well, I mean, there were two good reasons for getting the automated, and one was the pointing, but the other was the auto-slewing. That...
I mean, we could have got a ticker motor.
Yeah.
For the equatorial mount.
But then that's hard to... Still, I mean...
They didn't get great ratings.
Yeah.
And if your equatorial alignment wasn't spot on, then the ticker motor wasn't going to help. Yeah. Where with the go-to mount, you point three bright stars and it figures shit out, and it works pretty well, for sure. I'm not saying it doesn't. It was part of the reason I like the manual scope. And yes, I never saw Uranus... on the manual scope.
It's a 3-inch versus a 5.25. But so there's a...
Even if there was a 5.25, I would have never found Uranus on a manual scope. It was just too hard, right?
Yeah.
But it was also neat finding... I don't remember which galaxy it was. M31, whatever. On my own by saying, hey, it's near that star, between that star and that star. And this star and that star. Let me look here and see if I can find a galaxy. And I did.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very, very cool. Mm-hmm. And I did that with like divining from knowledge manually, not saying, hey, computer, show me M31.
Right.
And so there was something very gratifying from that.
Yeah.
and we've talked about this before, and I don't intend to...
I don't take it in an insulting way.
I don't intend any kind of tone on it. I find great fulfillment in doing that.
And I am more than willing to support you in that. You know, if that's what you want to do, then I want you to find your fulfillment. There's nothing I want more than for you to find than for, you know, all my friends to find their fulfillment. So if that fulfills you, then go right ahead. I'm not going to knock it. That fulfills me.
Right. I mean, for me, you know, it's we find something, we find a binary star with the go-to mount. We look at it for a minute and, okay, what's next, right?
I remember that comet that we found that we would never have found with that thing.
The comet wasn't in the computer, though.
No, the comet wasn't in the computer, but we were able to figure out, okay, where is it? We were able to use the internet to figure out where it's going to be in the sky. We were able to point to an object that was close to it and then slew around and sort of figure out.
I wouldn't say we never would have found it with the manual mount for that, with an equal telescope. We did the same kind of thing. We slewed around once we found the star. The star was bright enough to spot with the spotting scope.
Yeah.
Right? I wouldn't say it was impossible. The finding something like Uranus with the manual scope, with an equal telescope, would have been very difficult. It was a very dim object, and we didn't have to find it. We just had to look at it, right?
Well, even when we had it aligned, we still had to do some slewing to find Uranus. It didn't go directly to Uranus. We had to do a little bit of slewing to find it because the alignment wasn't perfect.
Right.
Because it's hard. It's really hard, even with the with the eyepiece I had to do the thing. It's really hard to get a perfect alignment on that. And so we did have to do a little bit of slewing, but then we did find it. So. You know what this just—it allows you to get a much better, a much closer.
So the question is, I would agree with the statement: the thrill is in the hunt.
Right.
Right. So with the manual scope, you might not find as much stuff, but you have more fun trying to find it. Right. And it seems like you don't agree with that statement. You would say the thrill is in the observation, or something like that.
Yeah, that would be more accurate to my feeling, which is that the hunt isn't what interests me. The spoils are what interests me. And what you can do with the spoils.
But when you're just looking at a little flickering star, I don't know. For me, the thrill is in the hunt because the observation, I don't know. Seeing Jupiter and Saturn.
Yeah.
They give you fucking boners. I mean, it's fucking awesome, right? But seeing Uranus and seeing a binary star and seeing a galaxy, not that exciting. The thrill is in the hunt, finding it. The knowledge that I was given.
To me, it was beautiful to be able to just, you know, point to an object and be like, yeah, you know, I can, you know, it's hard to make out anything, but.
Well, that's it. If you had a 15-inch telescope, then maybe the thrill is in viewing a galaxy.
Yeah.
But with a 5-inch telescope, looking at a galaxy isn't that thrilling.
No, it's not. And that was the real problem. That's really kind of why I stopped being into astronomy, because it became too...
It cost too much to get thrilling.
It became too
thrilling.
Expensive to get the thrills that you wanted to get.
Right. So, I mean, for me, I'm saying, let's find the thrills in hunting manually, you know? I mean, that's why, like, hey, I found M4 all on my own.
Yeah, no, that's great. You know? That, for whatever reason, is not interesting to me. It goes back to this.
It sounds like you would want to almost image and photograph galaxies
I'm not interested in imaging it. I want to see it with my eyes. I don't necessarily. I mean, because the imaging is there's a certain amount of fakeness to it because you're layering things on top of another. It's not exactly what you're seeing. Yeah. It's not exactly real. But it's like, you know, going. It like goes back to the quantum mechanics. I want to understand it. I don't want to figure out the next step. I don't know if I can. I understand that people are more talented than me are figuring out the next step. I want to understand where they've gotten and where they've reached and understand reality as best I can. I don't necessarily want to be the person who makes the next step.
What else you got on your list? You got a bunch of things that you haven't crossed off yet.
I do, actually. All right, so that Cosmos is the Neil deGrasse Tyson thing. That should be interesting. Why did cats dig me so much?
Why did cats dig you so much? Cats seem to like people that don't like them.
No, I love cats.
I mean, but like... You love hate cats, right? I mean,
no, I love cats. I love.
But
cats,
you have this reservation, like, oh, I love this now, but I'm going to hate it later.
Well, yeah, because I'm deathly allergic to cats.
Cats seem to know that because I know other people where cats like, hey, how you doing?
I love cats. I think cats are great. I think they're fun to be around. I wish I was not allergic to cats.
So.
But I am really allergic to cats.
Well, you had a bit. Yeah, you got here about an hour before we got home. Yeah. So you were hanging out here and Dusty came down because you were a human in the house. And Dusty's a very social animal.
Yeah.
For a cat, he's crazy social. I think he's part dog. But you had a huge red rash on your chin because he was like up on your shoulder or something like that. Mm-hmm.
Not much. He was not there like a whole bunch of time. He just brushed across it. Maybe at most 15, 20 seconds. Mm-hmm. And I had taken an Allegra. I am just, yeah. No, I had to wash my face to get it off. Yeah. But
so I'm,
I really enjoy interacting with cats.
I'm minorly allergic to him. I've noticed it in the past where if I live with a cat, I kind of get tolerant to it.
Yeah.
I'm not nearly as allergic as you are. But, you know, I had a cat growing up when I first started dating Heather and whatnot, so I was pretty tolerant to cats. And she had this very dander-filled cat up at her house. A little allergic to it. And then I moved out of my parents' house, right? So I wasn't near the cat that was giving me my tolerance. And this kind of actually goes very counter to a lot of allergen information that's out there, where you don't get tolerant by being exposed to your allergen, but you get more sensitive to your allergen by being exposed to your allergen, you know, that kind of thing. My personal experience with cats is different than that. You actually build a tolerance, but most allergen studies say opposite.
Really? I didn't know that.
They do. So there was a time where
I thought that there's allergy therapy where you get exposed over time to something and you can, your body will eventually stop producing the histamines that cause the problem.
That's not what I'm familiar with, but I'm hardly an expert. Go on, you know, go forward. You know, there was times where I was up Heather's parents' house, you know, and her big dander-filled cat was there. And I remember just being miserable. My eyes would be all red and itchy. Mm-hmm. Never hives like you got, but just mostly in the eyes. Itchy eyes, little stuffy, sneezy. And I would just, like, lay on the couch, close my eyes. Like just leave me alone. If I close my eyes for 20 minutes, I'll get better, you know. Things are... And, so that was really the worst cat allergy that I've had. And with Dusty, the first week he was here, you know, there was a little bit here and there, especially, like, I wanted to keep him, like, off my pillow. like, stay away. Like, and he was a very social cat, right? So he wants to purr and lay mm-hmm. right next to your head and stuff mm-hmm. like that when you're sleeping. Off my pillow, cat. Off my pillow, cat. And so there was a couple of days where I was a little itchy, a little stuffy. Got kind of used to it. And then it was kind of a resurgence. You know, I think it's getting to be springtime, so he might be blowing his winter coat or something like that, right? So he was pretty dusty. Dusty was pretty dandery, I guess about last week. And I was noticing a resurgence in, like, you know, allergic activity. So, but not this week. So it comes and goes. But generally, I find that the more I'm around things like cats, the more tolerant I get.
Interesting. Well, let's end on something fun.
Okay.
Star Wars.
Oh, yes. So, I tweeted the other day. Starting a couple weeks ago, I showed Max episode 4 and episode 5 of Star Wars. And Max is funny because, you know, he was really into Toy Story. And then he's really into superheroes. But I don't know much about superheroes. You know, I never got into comic books or stuff like that. And then when Max realized that I knew a lot of stuff about Star Wars characters and toys and things like that, and that I had toys when I was a kid, I was, you know, had a fair amount of Star Wars toys, he latched onto that. Mm-hmm. So he is as much into Star Wars as he is as into Buzz Lightyear and Wolverine.
Hulk. Spider-Man, right?
He's as much into Star Wars now as that. And he latched on. He's like, oh, daddy knows about this stuff. Daddy likes this stuff. I'm going to like this stuff, which is kind of cool. You know, there's a little bit of hero worship thing going on there. So he watched, you know, I showed him the way I wanted to.
That's an interesting thing. I also want to talk about it. What?
Hero worship.
Well, the concept of the weird kind of unconditional love that you get from kids, but it's, we interpret it as unconditional, but it really is pretty conditional.
Oh, yeah. Well, parents to kids is the unconditional. I never really heard kids to parents is unconditional.
Well, because, yeah, I mean,
the parents, kids, parents to kids is very based on stimulus and feedback. I mean,
it's very much an evolved response on both sides.
I mean, a parent who still loves their teenager, that's unconditional love, right? I mean,
yeah, but no, it's like, there's this, it's not just humans. I mean, other animals have figured out.
All right, let's do Star Wars first.
All right.
So I showed Max the movies, episode 4 or 5, yeah. And I got 6 on DVD over there, but the downloaded copy I had started like halfway in. LucasArts is or Disney or whoever it is pretty good at taking movies off of Usenet. So I actually need to either rip Return of the Jedi off of DVD or get it off of you.
I'll get it for you.
And so we watched...
Do you want the special edition or the non-special edition?
If you can get me the theatrical release of all the first 3 movies, 4, 5, and 6.
I'm pretty sure I can.
I'll take all of them. Because the episode 4 that I have right now
I think I can get the ones that were like based off the Laserdisc, which is...
Yeah. The episode 4 I have right now has some of the
special edition stuff.
And, you know, Greedo shoots first, and there's Jabba the Hutt. And there's, you know, other aliens, and none of it stands up to the classic special effects, in my opinion. So I would appreciate that. And so, you know, Max liked, he watched most of episode 4 the first time, A New Hope, without getting bored. But when he saw Yoda, man, he was won over. He really liked Yoda. Dude's no, not even 4 years old yet. So I think episode 1 is probably the best time to show him that now, and then never show it him again.
Yeah.
Because he's going to realize episode 1 sucks soon. So the thing Greg and I were talking about between recording was that I think that episodes 4 and 5, A New Hope and Return, and Empire Strikes Back, the effects are well done. There's only a couple of cheesy effects. Like, there's an effect in episode 4 where a Y-Wing bomber gets blown up and crashes into the surface of the Death Star. And it's a model effect with some pyrotechnics. Mm-hmm. And the scaling isn't quite right, and it looks a little goofy. It looks like Buck Rogers, right?
Yeah.
It looks a little bit like that. But other than that, the effects are really well done. Think of when Darth Vader and the Stormtroopers first attack the, you know, the Leia's shuttle, right? And, you know, the door blows open and they're shooting down. All that stuff looks really...
Practical effects are great. And, yeah.
So, just yesterday, I was going through my video library of all my RIP stuff and downloaded stuff. And, like, the Empire Strikes Back that I downloaded cut off about an hour and 10 minutes in. And I downloaded another one that started actually late. So neither of them were the full movie. But actually, I could show Max the full movie because, like, watch this one till it ends and then join the second one. The Return of the Jedi that I have starts, you know, when they're on Endor in the middle of the movie. It's, I don't know, it's so weird that I download these things that... They're still appropriate, you know, they don't fail unpacking, but they're not the whole movie. It's very weird. So he hasn't seen Return of the Jedi yet. I think he'll like that one because that's where George Lucas starts to get a little kid crazy, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, it's still a decent movie. And yesterday I was going through and deleting the ones that I need to re-download or re-rip or something. And I have Attack of the Clones. So I'm like, hey, Max, watch this. I go to the Jedi battle scene, you know, 2/3 of the way through Attack of the Clones. And, oh, he loves it, right? Lots of Jedis, lots of battle droids, all this stuff. And I'm watching it. And the green screen work is horrific.
Yeah.
The angles of attack and of motion, you know, you have Queen Amidala jumping on this big buffalo thing. And she obviously jumps on this just like... wheeled cart, you know, and they're pulling her across a green screen, and the angle that she's moving doesn't line up with the angle that the background is moving, and it's just, oh, it's horrendous.
It's a lazy directing job.
It's really lazy. So horrendous. I'm like, holy crap, is this, it's so shitty. I tweeted, you know, this green screen work does not stand up. It's on par with something like Birdemic, Shock and Terror.
It's not quite that bad, but...
It's there.
I mean, Birdemic was just... Birdemic.
Okay, it's not that bad, but come on. I mean, the money spent, if you equaled out the money spent, it's on par with Birdemic.
What do you mean by that?
If you subtracted every dollar spent for Star Wars to make the budget equal to Birdemic, the production qualities would be on equal with each other.
I think that they're equal in terms of the directing ability of the directors.
I don't think George Lucas
is a good director at all. I think he's a terrible director. And you had people at ILM who are geniuses who couldn't make that work because the directing was so terrible.
That's I'll give that critique. A possible, you know, yeah, sure, I can see that. I mean, yeah, sure. I'm sure the graphic artists at ILM tried as hard as they could, and like, this footage sucks. Can't make this work. I mean, but you know, there's that early era green screen where even a relatively static shot, you can just kind of. They did a good job masking, but you could just feel that it wasn't. It was two different layers on top of each other.
Yeah,
it didn't feel like one scene, you know? Even like the static shot. There's Amidala and Anakin just standing there and they're exchanging some witty quip that they shouldn't have because they're facing life or death, you know, situation. Fuck you, George Lucas. And, but just then, you know, just like, it's almost like the camera's on a Steadicam, so it's bouncing just a slight little bit, but the background's not. You know, it's just this tiny little thing where it's like the camera and the background just aren't keyed together just right.
Yeah, Lucas has no eye for this sort of thing, and he relied on other people to have the eye for it. He doesn't have the eye of somebody like Alfonso Cuarón, for example, who you know, did Gravity and
I still haven't seen Gravity.
And Pan's Labyrinth, and you know he has a knack for being able to understand the way the visual things work. Rob Schraub, who did the latest episode of Community, has a knack for getting that visual tone and getting those you know, getting those angles right.
Mm-hmm.
George Lucas has none of that. Or if he had it, he's lost it.
Well, that's it. I mean, I had thought that maybe I thought the first three movies were so good because I was a kid when I watched them. But I rewatched them now, I think with a critical eye. I think I rewatched them just now with, yes, I love these as a kid, but let me see if they're still...
I know the second one was Irv Kirshner directing it, and...
Okay. But, I mean, I haven't seen Return of the Jedi yet, but yeah. The first two hold up. I mean, there's some things. There is a little bit too much slapstick between C-3PO and R2-D2, right? I mean, just even in episode one.
Yeah.
So maybe I'm giving that a pass. But it's not like the bullshit that we talked about in Attack of the Clones, where there's the battle scene in C-3PO. Somehow he got it. I skipped past it, so I didn't see how he got his head attached to a battle droid. But then his head comes off. R2-D2 grabs his head, and he's dragging him with a tether. He's like, oh, this is such a drag, is what C-3PO says.
Yeah.
And then less than 20 seconds later, R2-D2 has dragged his head next to his body, and C-3PO says, oh, I'm beside myself.
Well, I mean, but not all in the dialogue is horrible. It's like the whole thing's a first draft.
Well, that's it. I mean, all the Jar Jar dialogue is shitty. Most of the Anakin dialogue.
There's no Han Solo character to balance out the horrible pretentiousness and the ridiculous slapstick. It's just poorly written direct, and it's poorly directed. And all the great special effects artists in the world can't save something that doesn't have a story.
Yeah, you're so right. You're so right. And that was probably the best of the three prequels, right? Attack of the Clones.
No, weirdly enough.
You like the first one?
Weirdly enough, of all of them, I think they just got worse and worse and worse. I think that the first one was horrible, but I think that the next one was worse, and the next one after that was even worse.
See, I have a recollection that Attack of the Clones was the best, but then the battle scene that I just watched, right, because like I said, I jumped through it and just showed Max the battle scene. I'm like, oh my god, I feel so dirty. This green screen work sucks so bad. And I mean, I have horrible memories.
It's comparing rabbit shit to
I have such
donkey shit.
I will be watching these with Max, so I will let you know. But I have such horrible memories of Child Anakin Podracer bullshit. Motherfucker.
Oh, it's a terrible movie. They're
Anakin
all
made C-3PO from scratch? What?
They're all three terrible, but they just get more and more terrible. That's the problem with them. And for some reason I'm thinking about those Matrix sequels too, which were just like the Matrix was such an amazing movie, and then the sequels were just like just utter dreck.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about the new Star Wars? Do you think it'll be any good?
I know J.J. Abrams is a competent director. I know George Lucas is not going to be writing them. I know that it's a fertile ground for storytelling and an interesting universe.
Mm-hmm.
If you combine that, then it seems like they should at least be superficially enjoyable, the same way the J.J. Abrams Star Treks were. They were not as enjoyable as the kind of pure Star Trek that I loved, but they were superficially enjoyable, and they were definitely fun movies. Well, the second one, not so much. The first one was definitely a fun movie. The second one had more problems.
I'm thinking, I don't have enough frame of reference to know. I was just thinking, what does it... Why can't they make good, really good PG movies anymore? Maybe they can. Maybe
they can, but they're all animated.
Yeah, maybe that's it. I'm thinking of Goonies.
Goonies would not be PG in today's world. Goonies would be at very least PG-13.
You think?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, you're probably right.
There's but violence in that. There's there's sexual innuendo.
I mean, Goonies was so good. I mean, it was, you know, the kids Indiana Jones, you know?
Yeah.
Just don't see that stuff anymore.
It's a different time. You know, now they have Transformers movies and
farting robots.
God. Peeing robots, too. Yeah. And jive turkey robots, weren't there those, like, offensive racist robots? Oh, boy. I think it's enough for...
Yeah, I think so. Fuck you, George Lucas. Fuck you, motherfucker. Anything else? You got a few things on your list. Anything to bring up?
We can get on to it next time.
All right.
It's already 12:30.
Really? Yeah. Holy shit. All right. Bye.
Bye.